I'm Julie Bullitt. I've been a family therapist for over 30 years.
I'm David Bullitt. I've been a divorce and family lawyer for more than 35 years.
Together, we have been married for more than 37 years.
In our professional practices, the two of us have been witnesses to individuals and families struggling with life's most difficult challenges. In this podcast, we will talk about the conversations we have had,
the conversations we should have had,
and those that every relationship needs to have in order to find success, happiness, and fulfillment.
This is Conversations for Couples,
the podcast. Good morning, everybody. Today we have an interesting guest, someone I read his book recently. He's a dad of three boys. He's an author of this, what I found to be a very refreshing book, a look at parenting, called The Four Lessons from My Three Sons. The Four Lessons from My Three Sons. He's a former congressional staffer, a presidential appointee, an Army veteran, and the least of his accomplishments is a Georgetown University Law School graduate. I say that because, you know, I'm a Maryland fan and we're not big fans of Georgetown. But Jeff Nelligan, welcome aboard. Welcome aboard this morning. We're glad to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a privilege to be on the show, guys.
We're really looking forward to it. And you know, and we've had four kids of our own, all girls. Yeah. But we do have two grandsons. And a lot of what you put in this book struck home. So I want to talk with you a little bit about that. I want to talk to you about, you know, your strategies and so forth. And I also want to talk to you about, you know, a lot of the same issues that couples have in terms of what they have to deal with. And maybe some of the strategies that you used in raising your boys can be applied in relationships. I mean, you have an outspoken approach to parenting. And so we have a lot to cover. And I want to start at the beginning with you, and that is with resiliency, because you focus an enormous amount in terms of your book and in terms of parenting your boys on the concept of resiliency. So tell us a little bit about that. What do you mean, and how did you apply it with your kids?
Certainly. The resiliency part of the book, obviously, it's the ethos of, you know, the 40-minute read. My idea took off, and I tell you, Julie, you probably saw this. You see this all the time over three decades. No one gets a free ride in life. Everyone's going to hit obstacles and setbacks and trials. And that's for kids and for adults. And for kids particularly, the sooner that they can get around and over an obstacle, the better, because the next day or the next week is going to have that kind of obstacle again and again. The problem that I see today, or the challenge, to put it more diplomatically, is that parents don't let kids ever get over an obstacle by themselves, that they're enabling. You know, the helicopter parent became the term of use, and now it's the snowplow parent.
Yes.
But the idea is that a kid hits something and you say, you have to solve it. And if you can solve something at 5 years old, you're better off at 7 years old because you have a history of doing that. And you'll note in the book that I give examples in which I put my kids in kind of tough, challenging situations and said, now it's up to you.
Yes.
And that resilience means that at 12 or at 16, the kid isn't fragile.
Yes.
The kid's not hiding in the basement getting really good at Minecraft, as you both put in your earlier episode about technology and couples, which was phenomenal, that addiction to screens, that kind of behavior becomes normal with kids who don't face obstacles and succeed over them.
One of the really cool things I thought that you did was when you gave each of your boys $5, right? And tell us a little bit about that, about what you did, why you did it, and the results of what happened.
Certainly. We were in, this is a hometown story. We were in Montgomery Mall in the midst of this swirling, you know, mass of people on a Saturday. And I had, you know, kind of decided beforehand that, you know, we were going to start this building of resiliency, and the eldest was 7, I think the youngest was 4, And I opened my wallet and I took out $3 $5 bills, handed it to each kid, and said, go get the old man change. This is not a race. I'll keep my eye on you, but you're going to have to do it yourself. And of course, they like this. This is a task. It's something new. It's different. And off they went. And I kept an eye on them. Of course, you know, you can't keep a complete eye on them, but that's part of life. And they ultimately came back. One kid had struck out twice. Another kid had a 20 quarters in his pocket. And they had succeeded at the task. And of course, we played this game again and again in different venues. And then, of course, I accelerated it. I said, we'd go to a restaurant and I'd point to the six-year-old and say, you're going to memorize all the orders and you're going to tell the waiter or the waitress what we want. Wow. And then it's pull into a parking lot somewhere and I hand the kid an ATM card and say, here's the passcode. Go get the, you know, go get me $300. And then it's we're at an airport and here's all the paperwork. Yeah. Go get us 5 boarding passes. So these constant tests, and there were others, you know, built in this independence, which is obviously a key to resilience in everything that they did. Yeah. And so that's how it started.
I love that. So, you know, as you're talking, I'm just going, yes, 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 yes. So there's a couple books that we read as younger parents. And one of them was a book called Blessing of a Skin Knee, which is just about similar to what you're talking about, which is like letting your kids get hurt, letting your kids fail, letting your kids get frustrated. The other parenting strategy book and strategy that we've used is also called Love and Logic. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but a very similar principle, just letting your kids fail and struggle when they're younger, because the consequences are much smaller and you're there.
Yeah.
And there's a safety net. And then when they go, you know, I've seen this in my practice. I've seen kids that parents have been either the helicopter or the snowplow parent that won't let anything happen. And then they go off to college.
Oh,
and then they're home in 2 weeks, 3 weeks or a month. And guess what happens when they come home from college and they've failed? They don't want to go back and their self-esteem is ruined. And it takes so much work to build them back up and to get them to try again. So I absolutely, you think that this is, you know, maybe not something that people want to hear, but I think parents need to hear this. Yeah. They need to understand this. This is wonderful.
That's what struck me really was that a lot of what you wrote, what you're talking about is exactly in a lot of ways what I've been talking about. We've been talking about for a long time. Yeah. And we see parents, friends, who raised their kids who never wanted them to experience any difficulty or any trouble. You see that out there. And then you see, and it comes from a good place. I mean, folks parent the way they think they should. They don't want, you know, the natural thing, right, is to put your arms around your kids. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about is to say, right, it's not a bad thing for that to happen.
Yeah.
Right?
But you have to have enough sort of self-esteem and confidence as a parent to be able to sit back and let your kids struggle. So can you talk about, you know, what you think you had and, you know, the mother of your children had to be able to do that kind of different parenting?
Yeah, I sure do. And, you know, I don't want to be a sycophant here, but I go back to that earlier episode you did on, you know, couples and technology. And David was talking about, hey, when we didn't have all this stuff, you know, we mowed the lawn and we talked about things at work and we read the newspaper. Mm-hmm. I grew up in that era, in that epoch of time where, you know, there was a lot more of a less self-examination and self-obsession and more, let's just do what we do on a daily basis because that's what we're handed. I've always said, and gosh, I hope I don't step on your toes, Julie. Our job
I do it
as
all
a
the
parent,
time.
Our job as a parent is not to build this perfect relationship with our child. Mm-hmm. Our job as a parent is to teach our kids to build a relationship with the world. And that begins outside the front door, the people, mm-hmm. the places, the failures, the successes, the hardware store, the gas station, the mall, the athletic fields, the church, the community. It's not to sit there and with this cocoon around us, as Julie noted earlier, to protect them from everything. Yeah. It's to teach them how to operate in that world, because by the time that kid is 12, that parent has spent 75% of the time in their life with that child. By 18, and this is where kind of Julie got on about the college experience, it's 90%. So if you haven't, you know, imposed on that kid your values and the characters, mm-hmm. the attitudes and behaviors by 12 or by 18, you know, that kid's headed south.
Yeah.
You're big on teaching moments. And I think you want to, and I try to remember a lot, because you have a lot of little hidden gems in this book, you know, that everyday life, I think you said, everyday life is a teaching moment, right?
Correct.
What do you mean by that?
In the real world, not in the fantasy world of a screen in which kids, you know, spend 8 hours, 47 minutes a day, in the real world where you have to deal with individuals and people, there are all sorts of moments in which you can say, that's the good, that's the bad, and that's the inspirational. One of the things that I did with my guys is when we were out and about, I pointed it all out. If a shy parent was being, you know, talked to by a very, you know, effusive parent, I said, look at that guy engaging that other parent, or, you know, a parent opening a door for a senior. You know, that's the kind of behavior I expect of you. If you see a jackass kid, you know, the parents are humping his gear and he's 10 feet ahead, texting furiously on his phone, you say, that's a jackass. And you never want to be like that.
Wow.
One of the ideas that I always came back to was, and it came actually because we were at a St. Albans or St. Paul high-end prep school in North Atlantic. We're driving in for a lacrosse tournament. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, and all the banners on the main drag into the school are justice and inclusion and, you know, diversity. And my kid, we're reading them off kind of silently. And I say, oh, but don't forget GPA, SATs, all conference. And I say to him, and he laughs. You know, this is a 10-year-old kid. He gets it. And I said, you know why the old man said that? Because the world judges you by performance, not by feelings. Your parents and your coaches and your teachers, God bless them, you know, the adults in our neighborhood, they're judging you by performance, not how you feel. That's the real world.
Yeah, I agree. And then one thing that I'm thinking about as you're talking is when I meet kids that are, you know, juniors or seniors in high school, I never say, where are you going to college? I always say, what are you thinking about for next year? Because I really want to not put the pressure and not assume that every kid has applied to schools, has written or had their parents write their essays or a professional tutor. And, you know, giving kids giving kids the option of like, you know what, maybe I'm going to work after high school, or maybe I'm going to take a gap year, or maybe I'm going to do something else. But I think you're right. Like the assumptions are, and how we judge, especially in, you know, our area, we're in the DC area. There's a lot of competition.
Yeah. So you also define what you call a good kid, right?
Yeah.
Four pieces to that. What are the four components that you set forth as being a good kid? And I want to ask you some questions about that.
Sure. And, you know, I say good kid, not perfect kid, because there's no such thing as a perfect kid, just like there's no such thing as a perfect family therapist or a perfect divorce lawyer or a perfect public affairs guy. The good kid has, and I thought about this for years because I was raised this way. You know, that good kid has personal courtesy, that ability to just handle himself with dignity and grace among kids, among adults. The good kid is confident, can go into any situation, not, you know, huddled in some drama inflicted, you know, paranoia, but just can walk in with ease. The good kid has that resilience. You know, we go back to that word, adversity is part of life. And the sooner you can handle it, the better off you are. And the last thing is ambition. You know, and Julie puts it well, what are you thinking of doing next year? Not, oh, did you get into, you know, Columbia? Did you get into Williams? Did you get into Duke? You know, just that ambition for each kid is going to be vastly different.
Yeah.
So those are the four elements.
Yeah. Those are good, you know, sort of good frameworks. And, you know, as a therapist, I have some feelings and thoughts about, like, those are great to be sort of striving for, but there's, you know, there's people that are born into difficult environments. We have two adopted children. I work with a lot of adopted and, you know, kids in foster care. And, you know, when you have early challenges in life, or you've witnessed a parent being murdered, or you had food insecurity, or, you know, there's a lot of things that happen to people. And that certainly affects your self-esteem. That certainly affects your anxiety level. So, you know, I like the concept of what you're thinking, and I love those things, but I'm also thinking sort of like what other people have experienced, what kids might be experiencing in, you know, an alcoholic home, or, you know, those kinds of things. So how do you sort of visualize pushing through those obstacles and wiring and all that kind of stuff?
Well, you know, those are tremendous and dramatic examples. And, you know, God bless you guys for adopting two kids if they've had, you know, those kind of experiences in their prior lives. Both of you see it, I mean, on an everyday basis. It's a parent engagement. A kid maybe is not going to be very confident, but you can get him to a level, or hit her to a level with that parent engagement that makes them at least feel comfortable in their world, you know, if not standard bearers in whatever they do. Mm-hmm. And the engagement part is key. And you guys talked about it again on that other episode, you know, part of that engagement to me seems diminished by, you know, this thing right here, that phone, that crazy glowing rectangle is the way I put it.
Yeah.
But a parent engaged is a parent that's going to have a kid follow them. It also comes back to, and maybe you talk about this in your practice, parent has to have a strategy, you know, I mean, a strategy for how that kid is going to be raised. And if you don't have a strategy, you're letting the culture raise the kid, which is part of the problem with this.
That's interesting. So sort of that strategy piece, and I'm thinking about something that we encourage people to do, which is early on in your relationship and your foundation of becoming a couple, even before you get married, sort of talking about what are your values? What are your, you know, strategies, if you will, how are we going to do this? And a lot of people don't take the time to talk about that. So were you able to do that early on, you know, when you started having kids or before you had kids? Did you know what you wanted to do in terms of parenting?
Yeah, I mean, the values that we had were obviously carryovers from the values in which we were raised. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, these are eternal values. You know, you read those four elements of the good kid, and you know, this is nothing that old Nelly, Mr. Original, thought up. You know, this goes back to Aristotle or Chesterton or, you know, Marcus Aurelius. I mean, these are eternal. These have been around in the human condition forever. I don't think that parents think about these too much, because in a modern age full of all of its distractions and this overpowering culture, there's no thought real given to it that we, you know, we'll go by the basics. We'll send them to school and we'll clothe them and we'll feed them and they're going to be turning out fine. And, oh, if they're really good at robotics, they'll join the robotics club. Or if they're really good at lacrosse, you know, they're going to be on the Landon team. They don't really have that push. And of course that gets subsumed by the idea of the helicopter parent, the snowplow, you know, that balance between the two.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, where was mom in all of this? And the reason I raise that is because one of the things that struck me in your book, and again, we're not here to Julie's a social worker. I'm not. I always tell people when they interview, talk to me, you didn't hire me to be a social worker. I'm not here to, you know, to hide things. I'm curious. There was little to no mention of mother in your book. So I'm assuming there's a mom there, and I'm assuming that there were some discussions. I mean, let's be frank about it. Your approach is a firm hand, is a different approach than what we see a lot of parents have. And so I'm wondering what discussions the two of you had, and how, whether she was on board, and how she, and if so, how the two of you worked to sort of manage this parenting style together so that you could raise successful kids.
Sure. I will always say, you know, my ex deserves 90% of the credit for how the sons turned out, and I get 10% for being a major league nag. And we had those same values, and maybe I was more pushy about some things, but we had those same values. It also comes back to, and I use the athletic metaphor because that seemed to be extant in all three lives. She was a phenomenal college athlete. I sat on the bench and cheered, cheered whatever team I was not playing for in high school and college. That ethos of athletics permeated the household, because in athletics, there are just three basic takeaways. Number one is the camaraderie of a team, and a team that you might not even like, a quarter of the people on it, but you have to get along with them. The second part is, if you're going to get on the field, you've got to exercise the personal discipline to be able to get better than your other teammates. And the third thing, and this goes back to the adversity, is the great thing about a game or a team is at the end of the day, there's a winner and a loser. And you don't want to be on that losing side. So you're going to try to get better and the team to get better. And those three elements, those permeate life. Now, to get away from the athletic metaphor, they're the same things you'll find in band, the marching band, or in the theater productions, or in the robotics club, or in the chess club, or in, the cheer club, the scouts. Anywhere you go, when you have a large group of like-minded kids working towards a goal, you'll have those elements. So she and I were on board with, those three basic values. And, like I said, she was, she is a magnificent woman, and she really gave them, the push, along with myself,
but Jeff, where they are today. Jeff, so you send your three boys in a busy mall with $5 a man, separate ways, place is packed. Mom know you're doing this?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And she was supportive of the plan or of the strategy. Yeah. See, that's the key to me, right? I mean, you could have come home and said, "Hey, look, guess what I did?" And someone's head could have exploded. You did what? You sent my kids running around at busy, people may react that way, but the key to me is, as I'm reading this, is saying, okay, these two parents had a plan, right? And this was a way in which to sort of effectuate, move that plan along, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So that was that's a bit very interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So it sounds like, you may not have been together with your ex-wife, but you were on the same page about how to parent them and how to parent your boys and really worked as a team.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it inculcated all parts of their life. We'd have them try out for tough teams. And because, like she'd say, they're only going to get better by playing against kids who are better than them, every single one.
Yeah.
It was the same kind of attitude towards kids.
I love that.
It's ironic that all three, of course, end up being military officers.
Yes, and I wanted to ask another question before I ask the question about where are they now and how are they. I definitely want to hear.
I didn't tell her any of that.
I want to hear about that, but I want to ask a question. If you could give parents advice on specifically I understand your strategy, you know, where you're going, but how do you manage your own stuff as a parent, as someone that is nervous, somebody that's anxious about, you know, letting their kids get hurt or fail or be sad or whatever it is? What would you say to parents, you know, a strategy or advice on how to let your kids, you know, fail or, you know, have struggles?
Wow, that's a tough question. I always go back to this. And number one is, and I'm going back to this, a kid has got to get off the screens. And the minute the kid gets off the screens, there's kind of a new independence. And the parent that is resistant to their kid failing, you know, they need to go to you and they need to burn up a bunch of billable hours for you or somebody to tell them, you know, your way is not working and your way will be, you know, 24 years old in your basement playing Minecraft.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always go back to that because, you know, you can't force a parent to let their kid fail. Counterintuitively, I love to see my kids in a tight situation. I thought it was great. Whether it was on a field or in a social situation with peers, wherever, I loved it because
So how did you get there? It was just a matter of the way you looked at the situation. Like, okay, this isn't like, oh God, my kid's in trouble. He's talking to an adult or whatever. You were like, you framed it in a very different way. You were like, okay, this is an opportunity.
Right. An opportunity, you know, David said earlier, you know, a teaching moment. Yeah, it's always an opportunity because I'm right there. You know, nothing catastrophic is going to happen. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, we go back to, you know, the old school method. They're going to have these kind of situations their entire life.
Yeah.
And they better get good at it now because, you know, the tight situations my kids were in, let's say, in Landon. At Landon in seventh grade are nothing. They're not even 100 miles close to the tight situations they've been in the service. Oh my gosh. So, and they perform in those tight situations in the service because they had that seventh grade scene at Landon.
I love that. I love that. That's a great, just a great visual, a great quote, like that, you know, seventh grade difficult situation helps you prepare for the later situations. So fill us in on your sons and what they're doing. And this is a proud dad moment. Tell us where they are, what they're doing and your relationship with them.
Sure. They all three, you know, with these values, I think the overriding athletic thing, although two of them weren't Division I athletes. The third kid was phenomenal. Actually, he was a Division I rugby first team All-American at West Point. But the kids with these values, they kind of gravitated towards places where and jobs where they had to, you know, always kind of be stepping up. And you're always stepping up at the Naval Academy or West Point.
Yeah.
And at Williams, you know, the kid had to step up. And then after that, he went, the eldest kid went right after that into the Navy through Officer Candidate School. But they're in environments where they have to lead, where they're making decisions every day, where every day is kind of a day of destiny for what's going to happen the next day. And they have tremendous responsibility and they do pretty well at it. And of course, you know, you guys know this, you parents of four. Every kid's going to go south. These kids, one of them could go south tomorrow. But they'll pick themselves up pretty fast and be able to, you know, move forward if indeed that happens.
Yeah.
Jeff, I want to thank you, you know, for coming on. I got probably another million questions that I could ask you, but I'll save them for another time. If folks want to get a hold of you, or get a hold of your book. The Four Lessons from My Three Sons, How You Can Raise Resilient Kids. Here it is, folks, who are going to be watching on video. How would they find you and where can they find your book?
Sure. They can find me and the book at nelliganbooks.com. And I'm on IG where I follow Joan Vassos, I might add.
Yes. She's lovely.
We'll try to make a connection for you.
Yeah. Nelligan _books on Instagram, Resilient Sons on X, and on Facebook, Jeff Nelligan Books.
Awesome. Nice. Well, nice. Thank you so much for being with us. Folks, we are The Bullets. That's www.thebullits at The Bullets on all major platforms, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. I miss anything?
YouTube. Everywhere you look, we're there.
And this is Conversations for Couples,
the podcast. Thank you, Jeff.
See you next time. Julie Bullitt is a professionally licensed clinical social worker and family therapist. David Bullitt is a divorce and family lawyer. Julie is not your therapist, and David is not your lawyer. This podcast is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only.